Welcome to the podcasts of JCC Manhattan. This is Susie Kessler, director of the Makom program for meditation and spirituality at the JCC, and you are listening to a recent Makom event called Train Your Brain for Happiness and More, recorded live at the JCC on September 30th, 2014. What can we learn from the intersection of one man's experience of practicing mindfulness meditation and the latest scientific research? In this lively, wise, funny, and wide-ranging conversation, ABC anchorman Dan Harris, who wrote the recent bestseller, 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and found self-help that actually works, a true story, a book that describes his search for answers after experiencing an anxiety attack on national television, discusses this question and more with Dr. Richard Davidson, one of the world's leading neuroscientists and experts on the impact of contemplative practices like meditation on the brain. This evening was co-hosted by Mindful.org, a community-building initiative and multimedia voice of the emerging mindfulness movement. Our co-sponsors for the evening were the Garrison Institute, applying the transformative power of contemplation to today's pressing social and environmental concerns, and the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Be sure to check back with us online at jccmanhattan.org or at iTunes for more JCC podcasts, or join us in person for our next event. And now I would like to present my co-presenter, partner, friend, the publisher of Mindful magazine. So I would like to welcome Jim Gimian, the publisher of Mindful.
To add my welcome to, in addition to all of you, to the thousands who are watching live tonight and the many more thousands who will be watching the video in the coming weeks as part of various study programs and company programs, who have heard about this and are interested in including it in their programs for their both their staffs and their clientele. So we want to welcome all of you here tonight and all of you in the future who will be enjoying this conversation. So the Mindful Revolution. That's what Time magazine proclaimed in January on the cover of that magazine. And it's September now, and it seems like the pace has just increased in the rate at which mindfulness, compassion, kindness, gratitude are being integrated into our lives everywhere you turn and are being used to address some of the major challenges of our time. Businesses and organizations, hospitals and therapists, soldiers and first responders, bankers and venture capitalists. I mean, where will it end? I was thinking, it reminded me of that great line that Yogi Berra said about the very popular New York restaurant. It's so crowded, nobody goes there anymore. And its mindfulness has kind of gotten like that. And we're glad. But there is indeed a lot of anecdotal evidence that all these various forms of mindfulness are good for you. They're good for your health, good for your performance at work, good for your relationships, and they can make you happier, and that's a good thing too. And right now, Dan Harris is one of the leading spokespeople for how those practices integrated into his life have helped him in all those ways, and he'll be sharing that with us tonight. As a matter of fact, I think talking to him, it sounds like since your book, 10% Happier, came out, that this has been like a second job for you, talking about with all sorts of groups across the country and internationally about mindfulness practices. So a great champion and leading spokesperson of how it can help. But if mindfulness is going to be more than another passing fad, if it's really going to enter the mainstream as it seems to, then it's got to be tested, it's got to be researched. And in our society, that's the job of science. And right now, It's the neuroscientists who are leading that work on all of our behalf. And nowadays, Dr. Richard Davidson is the leading spokesperson for the science of mindfulness, not just in his own lab at the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds, but also interpreting a lot of the research done by other scientists to see what's really supporting the efficacy of these practices and what maybe we have to research more and look at a little bit more carefully. So we have a very big treat in store for us. These two good friends, a conversation between the two of them that we'll get to watch now and in the future about how we can train our brain to have mindfulness help us and how we can all bring that into our lives. So Dan, Richie, thank you.
I just want to add a quick thanks to Susie. I love coming to the JCC, not least, there are a lot of reasons, but one of them is that I live three blocks away, so it's super convenient. And also a big thanks to Jim. Mindful Magazine is fantastic. You should all be subscribing. And Jim and his team have really put themselves at the center of this revolution, whatever you want to call it, and have been instrumental at making connections for lots of people, helping me make sure my book didn't suck, which was really, really useful. Some people don't think they succeeded. So a big thank you to Jim and to Susie and to Richie for making the trip here. So I think the way we're going to do this tonight is I'll say a few words. Richie's going to say a few words. Then my wife and I compiled a list of obnoxious questions for Richie. I'll interrogate him a little bit. And then we'll open it up for Q&A. And I'd like to leave a lot of time for Q&A because I think that's always the where we get to the fun stuff. So some of you may have heard my story. For you, you should maybe think about something else for the next couple minutes because I'm going to tell it again. If you had told me just a couple of years ago that I would end up being a wandering evangelist for meditation, I would have coughed my beer up through my nose. This was not something I ever thought was in the cards for me. Really, for me, it all started with a panic attack on national television, which happened almost exactly 10 years ago in June of 2004. I was on, anchoring the news updates on Good Morning America, a little show some of you may have heard about. I had done this job before. That this is the person who comes on at the top of each hour and reads the headlines. I had done this before, so I didn't really have any reason to foresee what was about to happen. But a couple of seconds into my spiel, I was overtaken by this irresistible bolt of fear. And my heart was racing, my mind was racing, my palms were sweating, my mouth dried up, my lungs seized up. I just couldn't breathe, couldn't talk. And I had to quit in the middle, which I had never done before, after gasping for air for a few stories. And I tossed it back to the co-hosts of the show, Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer. As you might imagine, this was extremely embarrassing and also really, really scary. Because I'm a masochist, I actually later asked the research department to find out how many people were watching. According to the Nielsen ratings, 5.019 million people. So, you know, no big deal. There's a little bit of a backstory to the panic attack. Let me just say this. The panic attack ended up in a sort of weird and windy way improving my life. But let me just tell you the backstory because it's key to this. I think at the root of it is something that a lot of us share, which is a desire to be great at what we do. I arrived at ABC News at age 28. I sometimes do a PowerPoint where I show the picture that they took of me on my first day at the job. I look terrified and barely post-pubescent, and actually a friend of mine has joked that if you take a wider shot of my security photo that they took on that first day, it looks like I might be holding a balloon. So I arrive at ABC, which by the way is right near here, and I was working with these giants like Peter Jennings and Diane Sawyer and Barbara Walters, and I was very green, aware that I was green, and self-conscious. And my way of coping with that was to become a workaholic. I just threw myself into the job. And not long after I arrived, 9/11 happened, and I raised my hand to go overseas and cover whatever happened next, frankly, without thinking much about the psychological consequences, and ended up spending a lot of time, a lot of time in places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, made 6 or 7 trips to Iraq. And when I came home after one of those trips to Iraq, after being there for 5 or 6 months, this was in the summer of 2003, right as the insurgency was getting going, I came home and I got depressed. And I actually didn't even know I was depressed, although I was exhibiting what I now know to be some of the classic signs. I was having trouble getting out of bed. I was felt like I had a low-grade fever all the time. And I did an extremely dumb thing, which is that I started to self-medicate with cocaine cocaine and ecstasy. Before you get too worried, it wasn't like the Wolf of Wall Street. It was reasonably sporadic. Not when I was working, and definitely not when I was on the air. As I like to say, I was stupid, but not that stupid. After the panic attack, I went to a doctor who's an expert in panic, and he asked me a series of questions to try to... Let me just ask Jim a quick question. Can I swear on this live? Yeah, okay, yeah, because I swear a lot when I'm not on television. And there's about to be a swear. Anyway, so I went to a doctor, and he asked me a series of questions to try to get to the root of the panic attack. One of them was, do you do drugs? To which I sheepishly responded, yeah, I do. And he leaned back in his chair and gave me a look that said, okay, asshole, mystery solved. That was a really big moment for me. I realized very powerfully what a moron I'd been. I made two big decisions in that moment. One is I quit doing drugs, which is kind of a no-brainer. And two, I agreed to go see this shrink once or twice a week indefinitely. Then a whole bunch of weird stuff happened over the coming... It wasn't like some clean Hollywood story where I just started meditating and, my life is a nonstop parade of unicorns and rainbows. It took a little while. I'm not going to give you the whole spiel because you should read my book, available at fine bookstores everywhere and Amazon.com. several years later, I ended up stumbling upon meditation, which I frankly thought was only for hippies and freaks and weirdos and gurus and people who live in a yurt and are really into aromatherapy and John Tesh and Cat Stevens and wear little finger symbols and make dream catchers and put them up on the wall and use the word namaste unironically. And I'm going to be honest with you, actually, I wasn't entirely wrong. then I did some research. When the idea of meditation was presented to me, I rejected it reflexively. But then I did some research and I found out about guys like Richie. I found out that there's been a really interesting little explosion of scientific research into meditation, and the results are still sort of in their embryonic stage, but they're strongly suggestive of a long list of health benefits, from lowering your blood pressure to boosting your immune system, reducing the release of the stress hormone cortisol, and somehow helping with everything from irritable bowel syndrome to psoriasis. And then things get really sci-fi when you start talking about this guy's work, where scientists are peering into the brains of meditators and finding that essentially it's a kind of, Richie's probably going to take issue with this, it's kind of like you're doing a little bit of a neurosurgery on yourself. You're rewiring key parts of your brain that regulate self-awareness, compassion, and stress, and among others. And then I learned that meditation does not require sitting in a funny position unless you want to, clearing your mind, joining a group, paying fees, believing in anything, wearing special outfits, none of that. That, in fact, it's actually simple, secular brain exercise. I'm not going to make you guys do it, but for those of you who don't know how to do it, but I'm assuming I'm preaching to the choir here, but here are the three steps, just because I found this to be really compelling when I heard, or reassuring, I should say, when I heard that all involved, at least for beginners, with these three steps. One, sit with your spine straight and your eyes closed. Two, focus your full attention on the feeling of your breath coming in and going out, usually on your nose, your chest, or your belly. And then the third step, as we all know, is the biggie. As soon as you try to do this, your mind is going to go nuts. You're going to start thinking about, what am I going to have for lunch? Why did I say that dumb thing to my boss? Why did Dances with Wolves beat Goodfellas for Best Picture in 1991? You know, why do celebrities only marry other celebrities? Whatever. You're just going to go nuts. And the whole game is to just notice, oh, I'm off. My mind is wandering, and I'm going to return my attention to my breath. And you just do that over and over and over. And it is essentially a bicep curl for your brain. And it shows up on the brain scans. And it is also a radical act. Because for that little nanosecond when you're able to wrestle your mind into focusing on what's happening right now, you are breaking yourself out of this fog in which we live most of our lives, a fog of projection into the future and rumination about the past. Okay, so after I learned all of that, I decided to do it. And I started with 5 minutes a day, which is, by the way, what I recommend for beginners. And by the way, I've checked that out with people who actually know what they're talking about, so you don't just have to take my word. And I've noticed that after a little while, pretty quickly, three benefits. I started to see three benefits in my own life. One, it boosted my ability to focus. I don't actually have any evidence for that claim. There is some evidence that meditation does boost one's ability to focus, but I'm just it seemed to me to help. But I didn't get my brain scanned before and after, so I can't, you know, you'll have to talk to him for, like, real evidence of anything. But we all exist now in the age that's been described as the info blitzkrieg or the age of omni-connectivity. And my job is particularly crazy. I actually have other people yelling directly into my ear through an earpiece, and the pace of news and world events is very fast, and I'm constantly being pulled away by the latest tweet, status update, text, phone call, whatever. And I found that after doing this exercise of trying to focus on one thing, getting lost, starting over, getting lost, starting over, it helped me focus when I needed to in a very hectic environment. The second benefit I started to see was just I can't prove this one either, a greater degree of calm in my life. Taking myself out of the traffic for 5 to 10 minutes a day just infused my life with just a little bit more calm, which was nice. And the third benefit is the biggie. And it's this word, mindfulness. It's a boring-sounding word, but it's actually a game-changing proposition. Because the truth is, we all have a voice in our head, by which I'm not referring to schizophrenia or hearing voices. I'm talking about the inner narrator that chases you out of bed in the morning and has you constantly wanting stuff, not wanting stuff, judging other people, comparing yourself to other people, criticizing yourself, and here's one of the hallmarks, thinking about the past or thinking about the future to the detriment of whatever's happening right now. My friend Sam Harris, I'm not related to, he's just written a book about meditation. He and I were giving a talk recently, and he said that when he thinks about the voice in his head, he thinks that he's been hijacked by the most boring person alive, who just says the same shit over and over and over. And it's mostly negative and ceaselessly self-referential. And the fact of the matter is, you're laughing because it's funny because it's true, right? And when you're unaware of this nonstop conversation, it yanks you around. It's why you're reaching into the fridge when you're not hungry, or losing your temper when it's strategically unwise, or checking your email when somebody's trying to talk to you. So back to mindfulness. Mindfulness is, it's an extremely rich word with lots of definitions, but here's one serviceable definition. It's the ability to see what's happening in your mind right now without getting carried away by it. I'm going to say that again just because it's so important. It's the ability to know what's happening in your head at any given moment without necessarily taking the bait and acting on it. So just think about how useful this could be. You're online at Starbucks, somebody cuts you off, what happens? Normally, you just think to yourself, I'm pissed. And then what happens? You immediately, reflexively, habitually inhabit that thought. You actually become pissed. With a little bit of mindfulness on board, where, you know, after you've done some meditating and you're able to kind of see the nature of the voice in the head, you might notice, oh, my chest is buzzing, my ears are turning red, I'm having a starburst of self-righteous thoughts, I'm getting angry. But with mindfulness, you might not have to take the bait and act on it and yell at that person in front of your kids or ruin the next half hour of your life stewing. This skill that I've just described, plus the science, is what's driving the adaptation of this ancient practice in some really interesting quarters. Before I talk about that, I just want to say, some of you may be thinking, don't I deserve to get pissed sometimes? To which I would say, yes, probably less than you think. The argument of mindfulness isn't that you, the proposition here isn't that you should become a lifeless, non-judgmental blob. It's that you should develop the ability, and this is the one meditation cliche that I really like, you should develop the ability to respond wisely instead of reacting blindly. And that is a game-changing proposition. And that notion, plus the science that Richie has really pioneered, is why we're now seeing people in executive suites at Fortune 500 companies, in Silicon Valley, where they now, where Wired Magazine referred to meditation as the new caffeine. By the way, I just think there's a delicious irony in the fact that the people who are developing the technologies that are destroying our ability to focus are now, like, doing this thing that helps them focus. Elite athletes are doing it. The Seattle Seahawks, who won the Super Bowl, have a meditation coach. Entertainers are doing it. The lead singer of Weezer, Katy Perry, 50 Cent, who I hasten to add got shot 9 times and deserves some peace of mind. And most compellingly, we're now seeing it being done by the U.S. Army and the U.S. Marines, who are spending millions of dollars to research whether meditation can make more effective and more resilient troops. Which is why I now believe, and I'm going to make a prediction here. Before I make the prediction, let me add a little caveat. My powers of prognostication are historically weak. In the early 2000s, I convinced my younger brother to co-invest with me in the company that makes the Palm Pilot. That didn't work so well. But I say the following with a lot of confidence nonetheless, which is that I think we're looking at meditation as the next big public health revolution. In the 1940s, if you told somebody you were going running, they would have said, who's chasing you? What happened? People like Richie came in, proved that it's really good for you, and now we all exercise, and if we don't, we feel bad about it. I hasten to add, however, it's not going to solve all of your problems. I can tell you from personal experience, it won't regrow your hair or, you know, fix everything in your love life or help you win the lottery, which is why I wrote a book and I called it 10% Happier, which is, of course, like everything else I've said tonight, completely made up and an absurd, unscientific figure, but it's true enough, and I like it because it's sounds like a pretty good return on investment. There are a couple more things I could say, but I want to close out. Let me just close by saying, if my wife were here, but she's 7 months pregnant, so it didn't feel like leaving the house tonight, but and she's heard me say this speech a million times and is tired of it. If my wife were here, she would give you the 90% still a moron speech. And my younger brother, the one who I convinced to invest in the Palm Pilot, wanted me to name the book From Deeply Flawed to Merely Flawed. So my argument isn't that it is going to solve all of your problems. My argument is that it can have a dramatic effect on your life, and that we all should be doing it, and that 5 minutes a day is enough to get you started. And here's my little tagline. If it can work for a fidgety and skeptical newsman, it can work for you. Thank you. So now we're going to hand it over to somebody who actually knows what he's talking about, and take it away, Richie.
Thank you, Dan. Well, let me just start by saying that you mentioned focus, and there's a study that was published in 2010 by some friends and colleagues of mine at Harvard who used smartphone technology with thousands of people. And they texted people out in the real world, and they asked them three questions. One question was, what are you doing right now? The second question was, where is your mind right now? Is it focused on what you're doing, or is it focused elsewhere? And the third question was, how happy or unhappy are you right now? And what they found is that the average American adult spends 47% of his or her waking life not paying attention to what they're doing. We can do better. When they're not paying attention to what they're doing, they also report themselves to be chronically unhappy. When I was a graduate student in William James Hall, even though it wasn't assigned to me, I actually read William James. And one of the things that he wrote was this two-volume tome in 1890 called The Principles of Psychology. And he has a chapter on attention in that book. And he said in that chapter on attention, and this is a quote from William James, he said, the faculty of voluntarily bringing back a wandering attention over and over again is the very root of judgment, character, and will. And he went on to say that an education which should improve this faculty would be the education par excellence. But it is easier, he said, to define this ideal than to give practical directions for bringing it about. I think if William James had contact with the contemplative traditions, he would have instantaneously seen that these are methods that in fact can educate attention and can help us in this way. In terms of the scientific research, we're living in an amazing time in science, and there are four themes in modern science that are occurring, which I think have provided an important foundation for the kind of work that we and others are doing to go forward. So I'd like to just describe those themes briefly. The first is neuroplasticity, the idea that the brain can change in response to experience. Now, this is what the brain does. The brain is built, it's the organ built to change in response to experience, and our brains are constantly changing. Wittingly or unwittingly. And I think most of the time, for most people, our brains are being changed unwittingly. And the invitation in this work is that we can actually take more responsibility for the shaping of our own brains to cultivate wholesome and virtuous qualities of mind, which also will have beneficial effects on the body. The second theme is the equivalent of neuroplasticity in the realm of genomics. And this is what we call epigenetics. And this is just wild. For those of you who don't know about this, let me just say a few words. We're all born with a fixed complement of base pairs, which constitute our DNA. But each gene has what we can think of as a little volume control that goes from low to high. And that volume control is highly dynamic. And how we are in the world, our demeanor, the activities in which we engage, our emotional lives, all affect those volume controls and can regulate our genes. So we may have a disposition for anxiety. We may have a disposition for panic attacks. But that doesn't mean that those genes will necessarily be expressed. The genes themselves can actually be modulated. And we published a paper in 2014 showing that if we bring long-term meditation practitioners into the laboratory and have them meditate for 8 intensive hours, we can actually show a change in gene expression over the course of just these 8 hours. And what we find, for example, is that genes involved in inflammation, which is at the root of many chronic health conditions, those genes are downregulated. Their expression is turned down over the course of this 8 hours of practice. And we had a control group come into the lab for a day of leisure, where they had an equivalent amount of sitting time, an equivalent amount of walking time, the same diet for the day, and they did not show any of these changes. So the second theme is epigenetics. The third theme is that there are massive bidirectional highways between the brain and the body. And this enables changes that occur in the brain to affect the body. It also is responsible for why changes in the body may impact our minds and brains. It is the mechanisms through which why sitting in an upright posture may be helpful, why certain bodily-oriented practices or bodily-oriented therapies might have beneficial effects in the way they do. As our bodies change, they will modulate the activity in the brain and vice versa. The fourth theme is probably the most controversial of all the four themes, but in many ways, I think probably the most interesting to me these days, and one where there's growing scientific evidence. And the fourth theme is that human beings are born with innate basic goodness. I'll say it again. Human beings are born with innate basic goodness. And what I mean by this is that if a young person, an infant, is given a preference as to whether they wish to participate or observe a cooperative and altruistic, warm-hearted encounter compared to an encounter that is selfish and aggressive, the infant will actually prefer the warm-hearted, cooperative interaction compared to the selfish interaction. And this can be shown in infants as young as 6 months of age. How do we know this? Well, you can ask them. And how do you ask a six-month-old baby? Well, the way we can ask a six-month-old baby is we can actually monitor using very precise measures. We can monitor their eye movements. We can monitor where they're fixating. And if you present video clips that depict these kinds of interactions, the six-month-old baby shows more looking toward the warm-hearted, altruistic encounter compared to the selfish and aggressive encounter. And there's more and more evidence to suggest this. So one of the things that we learn from the contemplative traditions is that the word meditation in Sanskrit, one of its meanings is familiarization. We actually have the opportunity to become more familiar with the basic nature of our own mind. And it may well be that at its core, the basic nature of our own mind is one that has these qualities of clarity and innate goodness, which modern research is beginning to show are apparent. So let me just say a couple of other words about the state of the art in terms of research in this area. The theme of neuroplasticity has clearly been a very important one in enabling this work to go forward. And one of the things that's exciting is we're seeing now the insights from the basic research laboratory being brought out into real-world contexts, into real-world settings outside the laboratory where we have the potential of making a real difference. And there are a number of such settings where this work is growing in influence. I just came today from Baltimore, where over the last 2 days, I participated in a symposium at Johns Hopkins University on contemplative practice and learning, where the application of these methods in education was being considered. We, in our center, have developed a curriculum for preschool kids that we call the Kindness Curriculum. And actually, Sharon Salzberg, who's here in the audience, has been extremely helpful and a collaborator in helping us develop this curriculum. the curriculum is being taught in public schools in the Madison Metropolitan School District. And it's a curriculum that teaches kids at this age simple practices of mindfulness and kindness. And we're teaching this curriculum in the context of serious randomized controlled trials. We're randomizing kids by classroom to assess the impact of this kind of curriculum. Now, why did we pick preschool kids? Well, it turns out that this is a period when the brain shows particularly increased plasticity. It's why kids at this age, when they're 3 to 5 years of age, if you teach a kid a second language at this age, it's much easier for them to learn. It's why kids this age have a much easier time learning to play a musical instrument. It turns out that the brain also shows this kind of plasticity for the kind of social and emotional and attentional skills that are cultivated by these contemplative practices. Jim Heckman, who's a Nobel laureate in economics at the University of Chicago, based on some hard-nosed economic analyses, has determined that for every $1 we invest in preschool kids with high-quality curricula, there's a return of $7 on that investment by the time the kids are age 30. This is a moral obligation that we have in this culture to do what we can in kids this age so that we can help them set off on a more positive trajectory. And our data so far, and we have a paper that's just coming out for publication very soon, it'll be our first scientific report of the impact of the kindness curriculum, shows clear evidence for benefits of certain kinds. But this is still very early on, and the work is really in its infancy. And one of the messages that I'd like to convey this evening is that we're all excited about this scientific work. It's helped propel this this field forward, but really we actually know very, very little. And there's much more work to be done. And let me just end these initial remarks with another applied domain where I think this work is going to have enormous impact. There's some reason to believe, based on the kinds of things that you've said, Dan, and that we've studied, that it's true, these practices are certainly not going to cure illnesses, there's a lot that they won't touch. But there's some reason to believe that healthcare utilization, that prescription drugs, the use of prescription drugs would go down among individuals who regularly engage in these kinds of practices. We need a study, a serious major study, to investigate the impact of the regular practice of these methods on healthcare utilization, on healthcare costs, on prescription drug costs. I was recently shown data from the Madison Public School District on healthcare costs that they have to pay for their employees, and I looked particularly at the single class of prescription drug costs for antidepressant medication for the staff. And that number was astronomical. And I'm not someone who's anti-medication. I believe that medication in certain circumstances, judiciously applied, can be very helpful. But I'm also convinced that we can do better and that we can make that number go down. And if we find that people who engage in the regular practice of these meditation methods show decreases in healthcare costs, decreases in prescription drug costs, and if this is really shown in a robust study, that's going to be a game changer, and it's going to be like gay marriage, and the world is going to change overnight. So we need to do that kind of study, and we need to do it soon.
Great. What this world you're talking about where everything's changed, what does that look like to you when you picture a world where is that everybody's meditating and everybody's like less of an asshole? What does this look like?
You know, it's a great question. I don't think that it's necessary for everyone to meditate. I also think that one size does not fit all. And you described a particular kind of meditation practice. I think it's very important for people to understand that there are hundreds of meditation practices. Meditation is kind of like the word sports. It comes in many different forms and many varieties. the practice that you described is a practice that's taught a lot in the United States, but it's certainly one of many, many, many different kinds. And one size is not going to fit all, and it may be that these methods are not appropriate for all. But one of the cool things is people often come to me for advice about research designs, and they don't have a lot of money, and they're using just questionnaires. And I tell them, instead of giving the questionnaire to the person who's meditating, give it to their significant other. Let their significant other report on them, and you'll get the straight poop in a way that is potentially more valid.
That sounds like a terrible idea.
Knowing your wife, she's also very kind.
She doesn't meditate, though.
And so let me tell you a little story. In March of this past year, I had a personal dream, which was to invite the Dalai Lama to speak on the campus of the National Institutes of Health. As a scientist who gets funding from the National Institutes of Health, it was something very significant for me to try to do this. And through my role in the Mind and Life Institute, about 8 years ago, we tried, and the kibosh was put on that. Circumstances changed. The current director of the National Institute of Health, Francis Collins, is really an extraordinary scientist. He was the former director of the Human Genome Project. He also is an evangelical Christian and wrote a book about science and spirituality. And he's a beautiful guy, and he's very humble. And to meet a humble geneticist is, like, really rare. and so
more rare than a humble newsman?
So Francis was game to engage with me in a dialogue, and he asked to see videos of the Dalai Lama speaking at other academic institutions, and we had some back and forth, and he agreed that this would really be a great thing to do. On March 7th of 2014, the Dalai Lama gave a major address on the NIH campus. He gave an address in the Natural Auditorium. Francis Collins has been on the NIH campus for 20 years, and he said he's never seen every seat in the Natural Auditorium filled before. But there was an hour before his talk where Francis Collins, the director of NIH, was going to show him labs at NIH. And this has some of the most advanced biomedical labs in the world. And Francis asked me what labs that I think His Holiness would be particularly interested in seeing. And I said, you know, His Holiness has seen lots of labs. He's seen lots of machines. And frankly, I'm not sure that that would be the best use of his time. There is a hospital on the NIH campus where people with rare diseases are treated with experimental treatments. Many of these people are quite seriously ill. And I suggested to Francis that rather than seeing a lab, why doesn't His Holiness go through the hospital? And let's have the patients come into the doorways. They can sit in wheelchairs or their beds can be wheeled out so that they're partially in the hall. And let's just have His Holiness walk down the hall and greet the patients. And Francis initially thought that this was a really crazy idea and asked me several times whether I really thought this was a good thing to do. And I said, I really did. I thought it was a great thing to do. And so that is what we did. And in the entourage, walking with His Holiness was about 15 people, many of them NIH Institute directors, some of them my good friends, some of them who have ridiculed my interest in meditation at points in the past. And they walked with the Dalai Lama down that hallway. And by the end of that hallway, it took us about 45 minutes to go down that hallway, His Holiness held every patient, touched them. Half the patients probably didn't know who he was. And by the end of that walk, every one of the people in the entourage, 15 people, we were all had tears just flowing down our face. They didn't meditate, but it didn't matter because the impact of His Holiness's practice was so powerful and so transformative that they totally got it.
I get this question a lot. What is the least amount of meditation I can do that will give me all the benefits that you're talking about in science?
I love it. I think, Dan, your advice is wonderful to start with really short periods of practice. There are studies in the scientific literature that show that 8 minutes of meditation among people who've never meditated before actually produce discernible benefit. We know from other research that the structure of the brain, the actual physical structure of the brain, can change in an hour and a half of practice. So the idea that our brain somehow, the structure is somehow fixed, is just... our brains are constantly being shaped very dynamically. So I would say that really short amounts of practice could make a difference. From a scientific perspective, we don't know what the optimal dosing is, if you will. And my own suspicion is that what's optimal for one person is not going to be optimal for another person. And we need to, I think, really look at this in a very broad way and a very open way and acknowledge these differences among people. But I would say that even really short amounts of practice and practice sprinkled throughout the day, ideally, can be helpful.
I mean, it's such an incredible idea. I think most of us assume consciously or subconsciously that our happiness depends on external factors, like the quality of our childhood, did we marry well, have we gotten a promotion of late? But what we're talking about here is that happiness is a skill, one that you can practice and train just the way we train our bodies in the gym. And that is a really liberating and empowering notion. There was a record store back when record stores existed in Boston, where I grew up, that I used to go to all the time, and they had a whiteboard hanging over the door, and it listed all the upcoming records. And it at the top it said, "All dates can change, so can you." And it reminds me of that, and it's a really cool thing. But just to get back to your point, so you think that if enough people start meditating, it kind of radiates out into the world, Dalai Lama style, maybe on lower levels. And that do you imagine a world in which the meditation is embraced in a robust way throughout the society, and that our behavior is somehow different in a cumulative fashion?
The analogy that you used earlier is one that I often use with physical exercise. We go back to the 1950s and many fewer people regularly engaged in physical exercise. I envision a time when mental exercise will become as regularly practiced as physical exercise, the kinds of mental exercises that we're talking about. One of the schools that we're working with, one of the public elementary schools in Madison, which is in one of the poorest school districts where 70% of the kids qualify for food stamps, we've seen a total change in the culture of the school after working in that school now for about 5 years. That school used to have the highest suspension rate. I was amazed that there were even suspensions in elementary school. It had the highest suspension rate in Madison, and in the last couple of years, the suspension rate has gone down to zero. The whole culture of the school has changed because the staff are all practicing. One of the things that we do is before we bring a curriculum out to the kids, we have the teachers go through a 10-week training. So they have an interior sense of what it is that we're doing with the kids. And part of it was a visionary principal who also embraced it, but the whole culture of the school changed. And you can feel it when you walk through the school now. I think if you measured the decibel level in the halls when the kids were walking, there's probably been a discernible change over the course of that period of time. So I think that these things can really make a difference. And I think in terms of healthcare and both psychological well-being as well as physical well-being, I mean, I think this could really be enormous, just enormous.
What if I'm not a kid and just say like a really ambitious, hard-charging professional? And you may know people like that. And I'm interested in being calmer, more focused, less yanked around by my emotions, happier. Is there any scientific evidence to suggest that I can achieve these things through meditation? Part one. And part two, if I do that, if I do meditate and do get some of these things, am I going to lose all of my edge and my drive and become, you know, ineffective?
Yeah, those are great questions. Well, with respect to the former question, first, my dear friend Jon Kabat-Zinn, who I was with over the last 2 days in Baltimore, one of the things he once said is that as soon as you feel the urge to tell someone to go meditate, put your butt on a cushion and sit yourself.
Can I just interrupt you? Because there's a great New Yorker cartoon that addresses this issue. It depicts somebody saying, "I've been gluten-free for 15 minutes, and I'm already annoying." So, I mean, it is, as a personal rule, I find that I have no problem like getting in front of a mic and saying you should meditate, but doing it one-on-one is a horrible idea. And as I said earlier, my wife doesn't meditate. It's because first, she would kill me if I lectured her about the benefits for her specifically. But it's really annoying to have somebody say it one-on-one. Anyway, carry on.
Yes, it is very annoying. So having said that, I do think that the evidence does suggest that someone who is hard driving, who's unfocused, and who is emotionally hijacked can derive benefit. The data show that in the domain of attention, the data are really strong. There are many aspects of attention which are improved by meditation. There are many constituents of attention. One is the ability to selectively attend, to decide to focus in one particular area and not to focus elsewhere. That kind of quality can improve. The ability to notice small changes in our environment. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in our environment of which we're unaware. It's actually hard to even talk about this because given that we're unaware of it, we're just completely blind to it. Yet we can show in the laboratory that stuff that you're unaware of actually gets under the skin, gets into the brain, and can hijack your emotions. You can actually be jerked around, if you will, by negative events in the environment. It can color your perception of other things, and you may be completely unaware of why you're in a crappy mood. And it's all of those unconscious stimuli which get in. It turns out that becoming more aware of them through meditation can actually help regulate your emotions and can enable you to recover more quickly from adversity, to cope better with the slings and arrows of everyday life. So the data on those things are really, I think, at this point, quite strong. And so I would definitely say that, that person can improve. And
what are the data on whether it's going to turn you into an ineffective blob?
Yeah. So with respect to that second question, I like to use certain examples like the Dalai Lama. I think that, he practices 4 to 5 hours a day. I don't think it's really taken off his edge. I don't think it's slowed him down very much. And I don't think it has dulled his capacity to discern.
But just to stop you there, I mean, Dalai Lama is great, but most of us in the West don't look at him as the guy that we're aspiring to be, per se. Anyway, you know what I'm saying. So are there others who you would point to as, like, this is more achievable, you could do this?
Yeah. So, there's no evidence to suggest that it leads to decreases in motivation or drive or discernment or... there's no evidence at all. I mean, it may lead to a shift in one's priorities so that one is working on other things, and it may lead to a reevaluation of that kind. But there's no evidence of which I'm aware that it really leads to a decrease in one's motivation or one's drive to do things. you know, I think that it actually can have the reverse effect. I think it can sharpen our ability to focus. It can call into relief our goals and enable us to pursue them with less conflict.
I mean, my experience is, which for which there's no data to support, but my personal experience is that I found that I still think that worrying and stress and plotting and planning, there's a certain amount of that that you need in order to do anything, to get anything done. It's just that we tend to make, or at least I did, still do, make our suffering worse than it needs to be. And so I found that the meditation has really helped me figure out where's the line between what I call constructive anguish and useless rumination.
Yeah.
And well, that has made a huge difference.
Yeah, I think that's a great, it's a great insight. With respect to that whole issue, there's a bit of science that could be helpful here. We as human beings have a capacity to reflect on the past and anticipate the future in a way that no other species does. And it's because of the real estate up in the front of our heads. This real estate is the prefrontal cortex. It is what enables mental time travel. It's what enables us to be able to recollect in the past and to project into the future. The prefrontal cortex has grown over the course of evolution, and the mass of the prefrontal cortex is much greater in humans than it is in any other species, and is responsible for this unique human capability. With this capability also comes the kinds of problems, and it can ensnare us in the way it does by taking us out of the present moment. I think it's fair to say that there's the incidence of psychiatric disorder. There's no data on this, but this is a claim that has very little data that I'm very confident in making, and that is that the incidence of psychiatric disorders, I think, is much higher in humans than it is in any other species.
Although cats and dogs do go nuts.
They do, yeah. But not to the same extent. They don't commit suicide in the way that humans do.
That's true.
And it's because of the prefrontal cortex, which can ensnare us in these ways. But we rarely, and one of the things I do talk about to scientists in training is that the invitation in this kind of practice is not that we don't think and not that we don't take our thoughts seriously when we want to, but for scientists, we need to think. And one of the things I talk to graduate students and postdocs about is you should build into your daily routine a time for you to just think and actually to pay attention to your thoughts, not to have them occur in the background and to catch them randomly when you can, but to do it intentionally. And if you have some event which is occurring in the future for which you need to plan, you can actually have that as your focus of attention, and you can actually pay attention to that and engage in that as an intentional, purposeful activity. We rarely do that. And I think that, again, one of the byproducts of these practices is an increased likelihood of using your prefrontal cortex in those constructive ways rather than in the destructive ways which can ensnare you.
I just want to check the time, see, ooh. We went longer than I thought. Let's open it up for Q&A. We have somebody with a microphone. We've got somebody right here. There you go. There's a working one coming your way.
As a scientist, I know that you like to be very specific in what you say.
Sometimes.
But it's also obvious that you're a man of vision, so I'm wondering if you could answer this from both parts of you. And two parts to the question, too. One is, how much of your data do you think is attributable to simple stress reduction versus changes in the brain? And the other is, do you think that any of the data might be generalizable to other practices that bring the practitioner to a similar state of mind, or do you think it's specific to mindfulness technique?
Well, with regard to the first question, I'm not really sure I fully understand the distinction between stress reduction in the brain. If a person is changing her or his relationship to stressful life events, as neuroscientists would say that there's got to be a change in the brain that is occurring that is at least associated in some way with that change in the person's relationship to her or his stress, to the stressors in the environment.
Wouldn't the downregulation of the stress hormones, for example, happen faster than brain changes, or no?
They won't happen faster than functional changes in the brain. In fact, they'll happen more slowly than functional changes in the brain. Changes in stress hormones occur on the order of minutes. Changes in brain function occur on the order of milliseconds. So it's on a totally different time scale. The changes in the brain happen much more quickly. Our brains are constantly changing, folks. Every millisecond, your brain is different. It's amazing that we actually think a self exists, that it's somehow solid, because if you actually look at what's going on inside, not only is the brain constantly changing functionally, but the actual physical structure of the brain, we're adding new brain cells every day, and they're replacing old cells. So the very physical stuff of which the brain is made of is changing. The study of the brain is really a study of impermanence. Your second question was about other strategies and whether they produce changes that are similar to mindfulness. I think that there are probably a number of practices which produce changes that are similar to the practices that mindfulness kinds of practices produce. But one of the, when we sit down on a cushion and meditate, in many of the traditions that Dan and that I've been talking about, one of the things that we invoke is that when we sit on the cushion, we're actually doing it not just to calm our own minds and open our hearts, but we are doing it to benefit others. So we're not just doing it for ourselves, but we're doing it for others. And in that way, putting your butt on the cushion is a radical act of generosity. And, some people ask me, well, does playing sports or does practicing the violin intensively have the same effects? Well, it might have some of the same effects on attention, but we don't normally, when we go out and play sports, we don't normally say to ourselves, I'm going to go play golf for the benefit of others, I'm going to go practice my musical instrument for the benefit of others. And I actually think this is an area where there's no scientific research, and scientific research critically needs to be done. But the very act of invoking that kind of intention may itself produce important changes that are part of the package of the salubrious changes that we're describing.
There's a gentleman right here who has a question. The mic will get to you quickly. There we go. I think we should say it into the mic just because there are people at home watching.
So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
No problem.
So first of all, I loved your book. Fantastic.
Thank you.
And I think for anybody who's thinking about meditating, it's really a great introduction.
Thank you.
Fantastic. So thank you. Second of all, I think you are good looking enough to be a national anchor. So.
No, thank you. Appreciate that.
That was in the book, if you read the book. A couple of my own experience. Quickly, I'm not anybody, but I meditate, and I found that I am more effective by meditating. I also find that when I move the energy from the front of my brain to the middle, when I'm actually meditating, I find that I literally stop thinking as much. So I really appreciate your saying that. And now here's my question. What you're talking about is what the Buddha taught however many years ago, right? And I'm fascinated by the things you're saying, but it seems to me like science is just dissecting what the Buddha taught however many years ago the Buddha taught. So, and I'm asking this because not to be a cynic, but to try to understand why the study of the brain is so important when the lessons of meditation have been around forever. And I'm not really, I'm honestly not being cynical. I'm trying to understand this. So I hope it's coming across properly.
Yeah, came across well. Especially the part about me being a good-looking guy. I didn't hear anything else after that. I muted it.
I think it's a great question and a really important one. And there are many different answers to it. One is that it is true that the Buddha has laid this out, and we have this amazingly rich, vast tradition from which to draw on. There are, I think, important reasons for doing this science. One is that science is a very powerful currency in our modern culture, and if we actually think that these practices may be helpful in a variety of contexts, one of the ways to facilitate their penetration into different sectors of our culture is through scientific research. And I think that today we're actually seeing that. We're seeing in a very direct way the benefits of this. That's why people like the Dalai Lama are so interested in hanging out with scientists and encouraging this kind of work. The second reason is that I actually think science has something unique to contribute that wasn't already discovered, if I can be so bold as to say that. And that is that first of all, I don't think that one size fits all. And I think that we could do a better job of helping people find practices that are most beneficial given who they are when they show up at the door. Often people go through a whole series of things before they find a home, if you will, before they find something that sticks, that really works with them. I think we can actually help facilitate that process using scientific methods. We can assess people's cognitive and emotional styles, and we can fine-tune what sort of practices may be most beneficial for which people at which points in time. Third thing, and I'll say something, this is something really different. The most well-established, using modern scientific methods, the most well-established empirically method for increasing neuroplasticity in the human brain non-pharmacologically is through aerobic exercise. The data from that are very, very strong, very, very clear, and very robust. I had an opportunity recently to sit with the Dalai Lama when we talked about he actually is one of the relatively few monastics that I know who engages in physical exercise on a regular basis. And we started talking about it, and the Dalai Lama told me that one of the things he does when he does his physical exercise is he does certain meditation practices as he's doing his physical exercise. And it suddenly struck me, neuroplasticity in and of itself is not good or bad. It's neutral. If you fill your mind with unwholesome thoughts while you're increasing brain plasticity, it actually has the potential of making things worse. It can help congeal and consolidate gunk. If you think about the average American gym where people are working out and then filling their minds with the gunk on television, that's a prescription for disaster. There is a new field which is about to be born called contemplative aerobics.
Is that true, really?
And I think
as if working out wasn't already annoying.
So I think this is another area where you will hear in the future from science, and that wasn't in the original Buddhist canon, and I think it needs to be part of this whole equation.
Thank you, that was really great.
I completely agree that the science is what opens the door. I mean, nobody continues to meditate because you think maybe your prefrontal cortex looks different, but you need to get people in the door, and science is the most powerful way to do it in this culture. I think we have time for a couple more questions. If somebody has the mic, oh, hi.
In regards to the treatment of anxiety, I've always heard a lot about cognitive behavioral therapy as, quote, the evidence-based treatment for anxiety. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on cognitive behavioral therapy and in relation to meditation and mindfulness.
Yeah, the data show that in terms of non-pharmacological treatments, clearly cognitive behavioral therapy has the most empirical support of any non-pharmacological treatment. For anxiety. Having said that, there is a wonderful development that's occurred over the last number of years called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and it's a melding of the basic principles of cognitive therapy with mindfulness practices, and that is has been shown to be especially beneficial in helping people to not take negative thoughts so seriously, not take the worry, the kinds of voices in one's mind that Dan referred to as seriously, and can be potentially very helpful to certain kinds of people. So again, meditation is not going to cure all ills, and I think it's very important not to come away with that, but there are interesting developments that are blending together the kinds of treatments that you're referring to with mindfulness practices.
Another question. We've got somebody right behind you in a blue shirt. Right behind you, right there. Yes. Yep, there you go.
I wanted to ask you more about what you were saying about epigenetics, and I'm curious if the changes that you've seen is similar to, like, you present a fearful stimulus and the amygdala acts up, and then you take away the stimulus and the brain goes back to normal. You know, this hour and a half, this change within an hour and a half or 8 hours, is this something that's permanent? Does it go back to its original state? Or how long does it take for this to then become sort of a permanent change?
Yeah, those are great questions, and we don't know. I mean, we don't know the answer to them. It's not like the amygdala activating. The amygdala is a little structure that's the temporal lobes are on the side of our head, and buried within the medial portion of each temporal lobe on each side is a structure called the amygdala, and it is a region that participates very importantly in different kinds of emotional processes. It's not like the amygdala firing to a fearful stimulus. It's more enduring than that, but just how enduring, we don't know. There are epigenetic changes that happen regularly to all people. When you go to sleep at night, there are hundreds of genes that are downregulated and other genes that are upregulated in every person every night. So the alteration in gene expression is something that is part of our biology. We know that epigenetic changes that occur early in life, for example, the way a mother behaves toward her offspring can induce epigenetic changes in the offspring, and those changes tend to persist. So a mother who is very nurturing toward her offspring actually induces changes in a whole set of genes that are implicated in stress neurobiology. And those epigenetic changes last. And in fact, there is some evidence, very, very recent evidence, these come from studies in non-human species, that suggest that some of these epigenetic changes are actually passed down to at least one or two generations. Mm. So if this sounds Lamarckian, it is, and it's real. And so there's really good evidence for this at this point in time. But in the domain of meditation, we don't know. It's really totally open virgin territory at this point.
Right behind you, there's a gentleman wearing a hat. Yeah. Oh, okay, yes.
How effective do you think neurofeedback is?
neurofeedback, if we knew what parameters to actually feed back, it potentially could be effective. My own personal view is that it is a bit of hubris to think that we actually know what the right parameters are. One of the things that I like to do in our own center with the scientists there is have periodic humility inductions. We actually know so friggin' little about what's going on, and to think that we actually can isolate one particular neural change and say that if we regulate this either by increasing it or decreasing it, we're going to actually help things along, at this point in time, I think is way too premature.
Richie almost sweared. come down here. We've got one last question in the front row. I actually went and did this neurofeedback thing recently, and I was really depressed afterwards because it showed that whatever I was doing was completely wrong. And then I was having dinner later that day with Joseph Goldstein, who's an eminent meditation teacher, and he had done the same thing and had the exact same results. So okay. Potentially hubris. Go ahead.
So I'm curious because you talked...
By the way, this is... Can we say?
Sure.
This is Richie's daughter, so.
Hello.
I think all of your research is bullshit. Drop the mic.
Well, this is one of the first talks I've been at in a long, long time. But, you know, the kind of folks who came back to the West, Sharon is here, and Joseph and Jack brought back a particular type of meditation that you talked a lot about, which is... insight-oriented and attentional meditation on the breath. And I know you've ventured more recently into some Tibetan practices that have a more embodied quality. And given the research that you're talking about, the robust research on aerobic exercise, I'm wondering sort of if there are plans in the works and how, I know that there's been some research, at least with the breathing, with the veterans, if you could just talk a little bit more about practices that might speak also to your question of other practices that actually don't look like the type of meditation you're talking about that look totally different but could be considered a contemplative practice.
Yeah,
actually, like Sufi practices possibly even, or things that are...
Sufi dancing.
Yeah, dancing, things like that.
I learn from my daughter all the time. It's wonderful. Such a treat to have you here. And my sister is here, too. I certainly think that there is an enormous opportunity with more bodily-oriented practices to further our understanding of how these practices work and what benefit they may have. We just published a study with veterans who have come back from Afghanistan and Iraq who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And one of the intuitions in this that motivated this study is that the kind of mindfulness practices that we've been talking about may actually not be the right kind of practices to help them calm their mind, at least initially. And one of the things that we investigated is more explicit breathing practices that come from yogic traditions that have, in my view, and some scientific research shows this, a much more immediate effect on the autonomic nervous system. Mm. Much more immediate, virtually instantaneous effect on the autonomic nervous system. And that it may be that... one needs to have certain changes occur in the body before the mind can practice these kinds of mindfulness practices in certain kinds of individuals. I think this is just something waiting to be mined. And there has been a tradition of research on yoga, although it's still in very early stages. And as you mentioned, some of the Tibetan practices do involve explicit manipulations of the body in ways that science has not yet investigated. There's a lot to stay tuned for. So thank you.
Absolutely. So as we wrap up, Richie and I will sign some books. Also, Richie's sister and daughter will be available for embarrassing stories about Richie anywhere in this room. Thank you very much for coming tonight. Thank you, Richie.
Thank you.